Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we explore the politics of Palestine in relation to the region and in light of its new status of statehood. Then on the Scholar Circle, what are the requisite pathways to building a real peace between Israel and Palestine? With more than 130 votes in the United Nations, Palestine has attained statehood, a move that is thought to empower President Mahmoud Abbas's position, both inside Palestine and in future legal battles with its neighbor Israel. This change in status, along with the other developments within Palestine and the region, may have more ripple effects. Earlier this week, we began a discussion with Mark Perry about the politics of Palestine and statehood. We continue now to make sense of the new dynamics. Mark Perry is an author and historian. His books include Conceived in Liberty, A Fire in Zion, and most recently, Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. Welcome, Mark Perry.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you. I want to go to the issue of the International Criminal Court and whether or not Palestinians pursue their case there. Now, even the French government, which has been supporting Palestinian statehood, has been urging Palestinians not to pursue this. How do we make sense of the French position?
I think we make sense of the French position because of the hesitancy of some states in the world towards an endorsement of the International Criminal Court. I was a fan of the creation of the International Criminal Court and such bodies like it, but the United States' position has always been, we try our own soldiers, and nobody else can and does. And there's a very strong argument made by the U.S. military that really can't be ignored on this case. It sounds like a great idea, the International Criminal Court, and in a world where there really was an international structure at work, it would be a great idea. But agreeing to the power of an international court is a secession, in some cases, nations hold, of autonomy, of sovereignty, rather, over their own military action. So I think that at base, the French, you know, would applaud the Abu Mazen initiative at the UN and hope that that's where it ends. It's kind of squaring the circle, saying to Israel, oh, let them do it. Let them get non-member state status. Let them win this vote in the UN. And wink, wink, they promise that they won't use the International Criminal Court. It's a way for the French to kind of unite the international community behind Abu Mazen's move while lowering the threat level that Israel sees by Israel. I think that it's a purely political point of view.
Let's look more specifically at Hamas, because you've actually been in close contact with the organization. You've described it as having a sort of split vision that really have resulted from all the new developments in the Arab world. Yeah. How would you describe the vision now?
I think we have to go back a little bit in history. In August of 2010, when Syria was beginning its long journey into civil conflict, Hamas had close ties with the Assad regime and recommended to the Assad regime that it seek reconciliation with its own people. And they laid out a program for doing so. And it was a very reasonable program, including, you know, calling the Constitutional Convention and reconciliation among the groups and talks and the opening of society. But it was rejected by Assad. And at that point, in August of 2010, Hamas thought that it could no longer support the Assad regime, and it moved its headquarters from Damascus. This caused real consternation inside of Hamas. In particular, the Gaza Hamas leadership, thought that that move was premature, unilaterally taken, and that the organization needed to keep its ties with Assad and with the Iranians. The outside leadership, the head of the political bureau, Halim Meshaal, and his allies in the political bureau disagreed and moved their headquarters out of Damascus and really broke with Assad and with the Iranians. The last time that Hamas received any money from the Iranians, to my knowledge, was March of this year, and there has been chilled relations between Hamas and Iran ever since, despite the split in the leadership over moving away from Assad in Iran. And Hamas has not only moved out of Damascus, but moved more towards Cairo, ideologically, which is where their roots are in the Muslim Brotherhood. I think it's a significant shift, but it was happening even before the crisis of August of 2010. Hamas embraced the realities of the Arab Spring, which not only affects governments and nations, but movements, political currents, points of view, and they began to reflect the views of their own younger constituency, which was for more transparency and for an acknowledgement of more openness inside the movement. And I think that that has been a positive and healthy political shift for the Hamas leadership, and I assume, and I think rightly, that the signing of the ceasefire mediated by Egypt really culminates, that move away from what has been called an axis of resistance towards kind of an embracement of the Arab Spring and promise that it holds.
Well, that brings up two issues, one dealing with Egypt's dynamics and what is changing for Gaza as a result of that. But it also brings up the issue of some of the weapons, which I understand in this latest round in Gaza were Iranian-made weapons, the missiles. The Christian Science Monitor reported that they have posted publicly in Gaza very visible billboards thanking Iran.
Yeah. My view here isn't a popular one, but I think it's a realistic one. We can't expect the people to disarm or sign surrender agreements. They're going to find weapons wherever they can. And Hamas is going to do that. And they have every reason for doing that. And they feel justified in doing it because they just lost over 150 of their own people. So I think that Hamas is going to attempt to rearm itself in Gaza. And they'll go looking for weapons wherever they can find them. And we're going to have to see as the result of the ceasefire what Egypt allows and what it doesn't allow, what it's capable of doing and not capable of doing. So on the one hand, while it's clear that Hamas has moved back towards its roots in the Muslim Brotherhood, it's kept its option open on rearming. And we have to realize the ceasefire, winkingly, but without saying it directly, said, you know, there would be a monitoring of weapons flow into Gaza, winkingly, under the title Other Matters. But it's understood that, you know, there's going to be close monitoring of what weapons Hamas gets in the future, and that Egypt will be responsible for monitoring that. So I'm not surprised there are billboards thanking Iran, and I'm also not surprised that Israeli citizens are skeptical of Egypt or other interlocutors who say that they're going to do the best they can to make sure that weapons don't flow into Gaza. There's every right to be skeptical.
With the changes in the power dynamics in Egypt, do you see a visible change in the relationship between Hamas and Egypt's government?
Well, the Hamas leadership is well-respected by Egypt, Turkey, and Qatar. Halim Mishal is particularly well-regarded in Egypt as a formidable intellectual and international thinker. And I think that there is a great deal of respect and reliance on what Halim Mishal has to say in Ankara and in Doha and in Cairo. I don't think there's any question of that. Will the dynamics change? I think that there's actually going to be a very significant change as the result of the Arab Spring and the result of this ceasefire. Hamas is now a player. It might not be a player in terms of being at the negotiating table with Israel, sitting across from Israel, but it's a significant player now in the Arab world. And it's going to be difficult for the United States not to acknowledge that and to shape a strategy, an international strategy, that reflects that. We can't ignore a country of 80 million people like Egypt that deals with Hamas. And we can't ignore the views of a NATO ally like Turkey when they invite Halim Mishal to Ankara. And we can't ignore the resource-driven policies of Qatar, which has turned into a major player in the Arab world. So we have yet to see what the changes are going to be. But at least to begin with, there has been a change of tone in the United States in describing what the ceasefire holds and what it means. And that's significant.
Hamas, you call a mature political movement now. I wonder, though, didn't they expect that if they did fire rockets into Israel, that they would lose 150 people? It made me question the mature political movement.
Well, it's a good point. My own sense of this is, and I will define my terms, by mature political movement, I mean one that actually represents the views of a distinct constituency. That is to say, not al-Qaeda, which doesn't have a constituency, and which isn't beholden to anyone, but is more of a gang. Hamas is not a gang. It has meetings, elections, it confers with its constituency, and it provides social services to its constituencies, both in Gaza, in the West Bank, and in the Palestinian diaspora. So in that sense, it's a mature political organization, because it's had to change its views in line with the changing views of a constituency. Did Hamas expect the recent war? I don't think it expected the recent war, and I don't think it welcomed it. There was a very slight uptick in rockets headed towards Israel from Gaza, but the Ahmad al-Jabri assassination took Hamas by surprise. This is a war that they didn't choose, and they weren't very effective in in counteracting Israeli strikes. It wasn't really a war in the classic sense of the term. This was more like an Israeli bombardment. And my own view of this, and I think it's reflected in reality, is that after 5 or 6 days, Hamas was looking for a way out of the conflict as fast as they could get. And they were running out of munitions and rockets, and they wanted it to end. But they were absolutely bound and determined not to end the conflict under conditions that would not ease the restrictions and the siege that Israel had imposed on them. They didn't want to come out of this conflict like they did with Casled, with a lot of bodies in the streets and no political gains. So they tied their agreement to a ceasefire with the easing of restrictions and access to Gaza, and that is what they got.
Finally, in 2010, you had written a piece about General Petraeus and a memo that connected Israel-Palestine conflict to U.S. casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'd like for you to first remind us of that memoranda and then walk us through what happened since then. Has it had an impact at all?
Well, this is a question I think I ask myself every day. In 2010, in January and February of 2010, General Petraeus, who was then the Central Command commander, and the hero of the Iraq War, sent out a team of his staff to question Arab leaders on the future of the region and their political views. And the staff came back and said, well, number one is the Israeli-Palestinian view, and they don't trust us as interlocutors. Most Arab leaders simply do not trust the United States anymore. And it's the single greatest obstacle and impediment to our bettering relations with the Arab world. And Petraeus wasn't stunned, but he embraced that conclusion. And then he sent his staff to brief the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on his findings. And I received a leak about the presentation and published the article on March 10th, 2010, March 12th maybe, in Foreign Policy. And he was due to testify the next Tuesday. And he did. And his first thing he said out of the gate during his public testimony in the U.S. Senate was that the non-resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was the single biggest impediment to our improved relations among our Arab allies, and that it was an obstacle to U.S. interests in the Arab world. And it was a stunning thing for a man to say. I think it took great moral courage for David Petraeus to say it, and what followed his statement was a political explosion in Washington. Since then, every single Central Command commander has been one or two, has said the same thing. The current Central Command commander, James Mattis, gave testimony in March of this year in which he led with that same paragraph. That is to say, the U.S. military is making it very clear to the civilian leaders of this country that their priority in the Middle East is the resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and it's in the national security interests of the United States to resolve the conflict. So the pressure's on. Everyone talks about the power of AIPAC in the United States. The head of AIPAC can call the President of the United States, and the President probably won't answer the phone. And the Prime Minister of Israel can call the President of the United States, and the President might answer the phone. But when the military commander of the Central Command calls the President of the United States, he picks up the phone. The most important lobby in Washington is the military, and it is imperative, because lives are at stake, it is imperative that the President listen very closely to the military concerns that have been expressed about the non-resolution of this conflict. It's going to be hard to do, but it has to be done.
And so how do you explain 2 years of very little action?
The fiscal cliff. The President of the United States has to resolve the economic problem and potential catastrophe that's facing the country. And he can't lose a single vote in doing it. He just can't. Can't afford to. And until that problem is solved, and it's the most pressing problem, I don't think we're going to see any movement. But when it is solved, and it could be solved, we will. But until then, he's not going to offend anybody by shaking hands with Palestinians. You never gained a vote by shaking a hand of a Palestinian. And the president knows that, and the country knows it.
Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Mark Perry is an author and a historian. He specializes in military, foreign affairs, intelligence analysis. His books include Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. When we come back, what are the requisite pathways to building peace between Israel and Palestine? We'll explore next. Stay tuned.
A father slumps back into his chair, choking back the tears, his fear realized. In the doorway, eyes swell with mother's tears as the uniforms draw near. Regret to inform you, regret to inform you.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. What are the necessary steps to establish peace between Israel and Palestine? We explore the psychological, cultural, and structural components alongside the more discussed political issues. Irvin Staub is with us. He is a professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's the author of award-winning books, including The Roots of Evil, The Origins of Genocide and Other Group Violence, The Psychology of Good and Evil, Why Children, Adults, and Groups Help and Harm Others, and Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism. Sami Adwan is also with us. He is professor of education at Bethlehem University and co-founder and co-director of the Peace Research Institute in the Middle East. He is the co-author of numerous books, including Side by Side, Parallel Histories of Israel-Palestine, Zoom In, Palestinian Refugees of 1948, Remembrances, and Participation and Reconciliation, Preconditions of Justice. We also have with us Sarai Aharoni. She is professor of political science and international relations at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. She is co-author of Where Are All the Women? UN Security Council Resolution 1325, Gender Perspectives of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. Thank you all for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. Irvin Staub, your work deals with studying why people resort to violence, particularly political violence, and you look at how we can resolve these issues. Do you think the situation with Israel and Palestine, and particularly now with Gaza, fits your model of the conditions for extreme violence? And if so, how?
It does. There are general principles in this, and there are also particular circumstances. In the case of Israel and Palestine, what started out was a conflict over land, over territory. But unfortunately, when conflicts don't get resolved, over time they become intensely psychological, so that each party comes to see the other as responsible, as morally bad, mistrust develops, and especially when violence enters, which has entered, of course, a long time ago, there is an evolution of increasing hostility. One of the things that happens in most forms of violence is that when there are no constraining factors, people learn by doing. Individuals and groups change as a result of their own actions. And they also change when there is reciprocal violence, when the other group responds with violence. So the hostility, the negativity increases over time, which makes resolution extremely difficult. So this is a very important part of what is going on now. Another very important thing in most cases of violence is that each group tends to hold a destructive ideology. What do I mean by a destructive ideology? A vision for the group that would provide something positive for the group, but that identifies another group standing in the way. In the case of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, many Israelis, not all, far from all, but a substantial number, hold on to a vision of Greater Israel, to recreating the historical Greater Israel. Well, the Palestinians living in the West Bank are in the way. That's part of the territory of Greater Israel. For the Palestinians, many of them hold on to the old historical view of a Palestine that is a complete country there, and the existence of Israel stands in the way of their vision of Palestine. So the very existence of Israel is a problem for them, and so Israel, by its very identity, stands in the way of this ideology of one single country, Palestine. And if I may just add also that historical wounds, victimization, suffering on the part of a group makes the world look dangerous and makes them feel vulnerable. And so as a result, other groups are potential enemies and they are likely to strike out against these others. because they believe they need to do that to defend themselves. Now, one of the challenges over time is that woundedness could lead to a feeling of vulnerability and moving towards healing. And sometimes people, as they heal, their heart opens to others who suffer, and they are likely to be more caring about others. But woundedness in these cases, both for Israelis and Palestinians, became kind of covered up by a hard shell that we need to defend ourselves, we need to fight for our rights, we need to protect ourselves in the case of Israelis, we need to fight for our rights in the case of Palestinians. So there isn't the kind of openness that woundedness potentially could create. Instead, it contributes to continuing hostility. So these are some of the elements: historical woundedness, a destructive ideology, mistrust of each other, the conflict moving from material issues also to psychological issues, and issues of identity are all very important things that contribute to maintain the ongoing conflict.
One other thing that you had written about in your books is the cultural situation that either makes violence more fitting for the situation or not. How do you see that in this particular situation?
When I talk about cultural circumstances or conditions that contribute to violence, they are, one of the elements is a history of devaluation of the other, which means that at times when there are problems, difficult life conditions, for example, or material conflict, then the other is likely to be blamed for it. Now, this historical devaluation has been present. It has been part of Jews and Palestinians from before the creation of the state to different extents, and it has intensified over time. And unfortunately, it is maintained. It is maintained in textbooks. It is maintained by the difficulty of considering the other situation, the kind of work that Somi Adwan has tried to address. And so that's one thing. But this other thing that I was talking about, woundedness, is another cultural characteristic. It becomes part of the group. Sometimes the group focuses on historical victimization, and that becomes part of their culture. It is part of their identity, and then they act out of that. Their perception of the world is shaped by what they have experienced and seeing the world as dangerous to them. So that is a cultural characteristic. Sometimes another cultural characteristic is overly strong respect for authority. Now, Somi Adwan would be more able to speak to this because he understands Palestinian culture better. I don't think that that is necessarily the case in Israeli society, although whenever is in a society under attack and in crisis, even when culturally their tendency is not so much to obey authorities, this tendency to obey authorities increases because of the threat to the group and people's vulnerability. They turn to authorities who then lead them, and unfortunately all too often lead them in the wrong direction.
Somi Adwan, you've been prompted twice, one on the issue of culture and authoritarian following, but the other on the use of education, which you confronted with your projects. Let's first talk about those cultural and structural elements, and then later how you've dealt with it.
As the Israeli and Palestinian, we're engaged in this protracted conflict that creates a cultural of we and they, and we are the victim and they are the victimizers. And in that structure creates so much inferiority in the we group against the other group, and that develops a mechanism of self-defense and self-embracing of your ideology and your ideology and your ambitions that's really being hijacked or being used by authority or leaders who happen to hold or embrace these kind of ideology of defense. And the way to do that is to being so much authoritarian in their society, which leads of a mass movement towards this ideology and how to see the other as one group and the other is another group. In the case of Palestinians, we are really facing completely different situation. Of course, we are a very vulnerable society, in all aspects of life, when we try to analyze the asymmetric relationship that exists between the Palestinians and Israelis, I mean, here you have a superpower versus masses of people. Here you have a very sophisticated, developed state that occupy the others. And in that sense, that creates a very cultural inhibition of the society, which leads to some disparity and they create in the individual and the collective, which try to get rid of these kind of oppression or their subjugation through means of defense, which we call defense, which sometimes it's called being violent or it's called being terrorist, but it's a defense mechanism that a society engage in this conflict, especially when this society is under oppression, that always become defensive and try to see themselves as in a course of victimation throughout the history. And now the victimation that Palestinian culture is dominant with now, it's not only related to Israeli occupation or oppression or policies, but also it's really extended to the authoritarian that being presented in the international community. I mean, UN General Council, UN Security Council, the politics of international media, and how this being manipulated throughout the media. So here, the authority is seen from the Palestinian side in one way, feel it's a challenge if within the society to create their own leadership and how to follow a strong leadership and what's the power that this leadership could achieve in the course. And at the same time, the Palestinian feels that they are wrongly judged in the course of history. What creates the dynamics between cultural movements and cultural struggle in the direction of relating to authority in the course of conflict, it becomes so much layered and so much unclear.
The other thing I would want to understand, and it's something I've seen in your papers, deals with how these things are reinforced specifically through textbooks. And I ask this specifically because that's what you've been working on.
We started this project almost 12 years ago, and it was basically going through what information Palestinian and Israeli ran throughout their schooling and through their textbooks. The basic finding is very clear. In any societies engaging opposition and conflict, both society focus its own narrative and it exists by itself and it's always legitimate and it's always right. And the other side is hardly mentioned in the other side textbooks. So here there's no complete, so much focus on the self and so much denial on the others. That comes also with the issue of legitimacy, as we found in both schools' books, Palestinian and Israeli, there's certain level, a high level actually, of delegitimization of each other existence. It goes along what was Irving saying, we are here and we have the right to be here, and the others is not at all legitimized to their claim and to their narratives. From the other side, you can find the dehumanization of the others in different forms, either as individual, as a group, and also the historical coexistence of peaceful coexistence between Palestinian and Israelis hardly mentioned in both sides' textbooks. To say the least, that each side textbooks fail to include in its own content any kind of material or any kind of information related to the other side. Here, bring the children of both sides feeling that the other side doesn't exist at all, or there is no place for him or her to be existed. Denial, dehumanization, delegitimization, and demonization is the main characteristics of both sides.
Saraya Haroni, give us an idea of how gender has played a role here.
I've been focusing on issues that relate to gender within Israel and the way the Israeli gender regime has been related, interconnected to the ongoing conflict. And I think that the gender issue connects the question of the conflict with the identity of the State of Israel as a democracy, with the question of militarization and what this securitization, this ongoing process of armed conflict that is being transmitted through generations, what does it do to women, to women's equality, and to their possibility to actually change this reality? I had focused on various aspects of the influence of the ongoing conflict on women's political attitudes, their participation, their vulnerabilities, the way their vulnerabilities, when we talk about Israeli women, we actually don't talk about a homogenous group. This is a very diverse group of people who have been affected very differently by the ongoing conflict, and Jewish women, Israeli-Palestinian women, women settlers, Mizrahi women, meaning women who are Oriental Jews, all of these different groups have actually experienced the conflict very differently. And these experiences have shaped women's political attitudes. And this is important because listening to women is a way for us to learn about transmission of knowledge. It helps us to understand the possibilities of people to dissent, to engage in political action that is opposition to whatever official governmental policies require. It tells us something about identity. Women's political participation also tells us something about the public sphere and the extent to which the Israeli public sphere is actually open to different voices, voices that are not identified with military power, voices that are not masculine, voices that do offer some kind of alternative. And we know that peace, especially in Western cultures, is identified with, to some extent, with femininity and with the ability to reconcile differences. Now, I don't really think that Israeli women are more peaceful than Israeli men, and we cannot prove that. We've tried to ask them, what do they think about peace? And we really found these striking and very depressing reality of the sense of complete disillusionment and despair. And women were not even able to imagine a future in which there would be some kind of a peaceful coexistence or existence. And I think this is really troubling. It gives us a sense of the actual way that people feel about reality and think that this reality could be changed. We did get a sense that the ongoing exposure of women and civilians in general to political violence, and I'm referring now to the period of the Second Intifada, which had affected Israeli civilian population, to the Second Lebanon War, and to the ongoing rocket attacks in southern Israel. Now, these have been clear experiences of insecurity. We found, I think, that one in every fourth Israeli woman had reported being exposed to some form of political violence. We think that this might be an indication to their political attitudes, which are currently quite similar to those of the Israeli government, which is a right-wing government.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the necessary preconditions to build peace between Israel and Palestine. If we have one in four women experiencing this, and we have on the Palestinian side this experience of oppression and marginalization, let's now examine what are the ways forward to creating not simply peace, but reconciliation and even, dare I say, friendship between Israelis and Palestinians. Irvin Saab, let's go back to you first. You've worked on both Israel-Palestine as well as Rwanda. Let's lay out what the most important aspects of reconciliation are in a situation like this that is so entrenched. How do we start?
These two people are in a really tough situation right now, given the level of hostility, the level of separateness, and attitudes towards each other, everything. And I think that a really important thing here is for what I call external bystanders seriously engaging. These external parties cannot create peace, but they can exert important influence to get people within the country to begin to move in certain directions. Who are these external bystanders? The United States, American Jews, Arab countries. All of these need to engage, and ideally they should form some kind of a coalition on the outside to engage, not only in the political realm, but in order to exert an influence to generate internal constructive leadership and to get people within these countries to begin to move away from the right-wing hostile attitudes that are increasing in both groups. Now, And other really important thing that relates to this is that for people in both countries to begin to initiate some positive action towards the other. I was talking about the evolution of hostility and antagonism and violence, but evolution goes in both directions. There is a lot of evidence looking at children, looking at adults who engage in positive actions, looking at groups, that when you begin to take positive actions, you also change in a positive direction, especially if there is a reciprocal interaction, if there is a positive response. So you have to begin to do this in order to generate some trust, and generate the opportunity to really create a difference. And other thing is, it's very important for leaders on the two sides to engage in persistent dialogue. What happened over many years now is that there is a very limited little dialogue, and then there is nothing for a very long time. So there is no opportunity to develop trust, interaction with each other. And so persistent engagement is important. I was talking about destructive visions. The two countries, the two people need a constructive shared vision of the future. What can that be? Well, one could be the vision of an economic community where both parties contribute and then both parties have gains. I am going fast one by one, and we may return to some of these things. Education is extremely important. Sami is working with education in the schools. That is really crucial to create more positive attitudes towards the other. Also, education can have a role in creating more of a shared history. As he was saying, and as I very much think, what happens is that the two groups develop their own history in which the other is at fault and the other is to blame. There can be changes in these narratives of each group. There has been some change in Israel, for example, in that initially the Israelis claimed that Palestinians became refugees because their leaders told them to leave for the period of time while there is going to be fighting against Israel in the so-called War of Independence, or Nakba, the tragedy, as the Palestinians call it. And so the only reason that they left was because their leaders told them to leave. Well, it turns out that they left for many reasons. They left because their leaders told them to leave. They left because there was fighting nearby and they wanted to escape from it. And they left also because they were intimidated and expelled by the Israelis. On the Palestinian side, the narrative is that they only left because they were expelled. Research has shown that that's also incorrect. So education about these things can change these narratives of each group and lead more of a joint history. Education can also have other forms. In Rwanda and Burundi and the Congo, we have been doing trainings and workshops for various groups, but also created educational radio programs in which there is information embedded in stories, or the education is presented in a straightforward way about what are the forces that lead to violence, what are ways to try to promote reconciliation between groups. And this information seems to have some significant impact on the population. So these are some of the many elements that are really important to develop more positive attitudes towards the other, to develop engagement. Let me just add that in terms of this shared history, education in the schools is valuable. Education through radio and television is valuable. But there have also been, in other cases, commissions, joint commissions of two groups that look at the history of the two groups, talk about what actually happened, come out with a report that begins to change the way people see the history that has taken place between the two of them.
Like South Africa.
Well, South Africa, or after the war, Second World War, there was a German-Czech commission, for example, to look at the history of the relations between the two countries and at other places. But let me just return to my first point and then stop. And that is, given how these two people are almost intertwined in I'm sorry to use this phrase, but almost in a death embrace of each other. External bystanders who are truly committed, who are courageous, or American leadership who doesn't wimp out when they try to do something, move one of the countries toward positive action, and then there is resistance, maybe by the other party, maybe a subgroup of the society, and then our president and previous presidents, you know, George H. Bush tried to do something about the settlements, and when there was opposition to it, he gave up. So we need a certain kind of commitment in order to push and move these two parties toward more constructive actions in relation to each other.
Sami Yadwan, let's bring you back in now to talk specifically more about what your experience has been with the Textbook Project and the Shared History Project. How did that develop, and where is it now, and what have the results been?
Well, I just want to first make comments that what Sri was reporting about, there's one Israeli out of four women exposed to political violence. That's true, but if you look at the Palestinian, maybe four out of four women are exposed to daily political violence. Now, back to our project, what we try to do, how to create a change, how to move the education from continue perpetuating the conflict to be a means for peaceful resolutions. We have completely opposite narrative of certain places and issues and events. We thought to move this issues of denial of existence of the other narrative to what we call a dual narrative approach. We recruited Palestinian and Israeli teachers, and both sides start writing how they narrate their histories, and we put it together. So we put the Balfour Declaration from the Israeli side, how it's been seen, from the Palestinian side, the 1948 war, the 1967, the peace accord. So we put these two narratives opposite to each other in a way to allow children in both sides, and teachers, of course, and communities and parents, to know there is different narrative exist besides my own narrative. How to deal with these issues, how to create a discussion between yourself and your narrative in the light of the existence and recognition of the other side narrative. We never meant to move the children from deconstructing their narrative, but as a first step to recognize that there is narrative that exists, and it happened that the other side narrative is opposite to mine. We put in the book that we publish an empty space between the two sides narrative so the children and the teachers can engage in this discussion of narrative. We feel in our project, we call it a bottom-up approach of resolving a conflict, meaning moving generation of Palestinian children from to recognize the existence of the other narrative and at the same time to live with these different narratives. There is no way for the Palestinian and the Israeli to try to forget or deny their own narrative. It's part of their national identity. It's part of their individual and society and cultural modes. So they have the right to live with it, but how to live with it and accept existence of other narratives. We succeeded in producing the 20th century narrative, both sides together in one book. Unfortunately, both ministries of education reject our project. So here we deal with the issue how to influence political leaders and how to influence the decision makers to take an action. We felt at a certain point that we failed to influence the political leaders on both sides. So we moved to what we call it a process-oriented approach, where we'd like to educate children as much as we can that in the other side there's a human part. It's not all enemy, etc. So we gradually we try to open mind the children of both sides of this approach to both narratives to discuss it and to move on to reconciliation. We will never reach reconciliation until there's a recognition of each other side narratives. Also, to deal with the future, we have to deal with the historical narrative. We cannot carry the historical narrative with completely in ignorance with the other side narrative and try to reach a political solution. We continue to train teachers because teachers are the emissaries of their narrative, and we have to educate them how to deal with these two opposing narratives, how to deal with them in their classroom, how to present it to their students, what kind of question they expect from students, how they should react with certain emotions when it comes. Because teaching history is not an objective presentation of the past. It comes with the human and emotional aspect. So how to deal with the issue. For example, when the teachers deal with the 1948 in the Palestinian side, that's the year of the catastrophe where dreams has been disappeared. That comes with sadness, emotions, and trauma. When you deal with the 1948 from the Israeli side as the year of independence, where the dreams came true. So here we deal with a reality. We are walking uphill road that never ends, meaning that the daily reality has its own stake on influencing our work. While we try to open the hearts and minds of the children of both sides, there's a different reality what happens to them in day-to-day basis. Checkpoints, settlers' attacks, destroying homes, shelling with F-16. People are living in siege. So also Israelis are threatened, a feeling of insecurity. We have to create an educational process that slowly and slowly try to get the fear out and be replaced by a positive and promising futures. Otherwise, we're just trying to put ourselves in a very ideal situation with raising high hopes, and at the same time, we face a complete kind of frustrations. We've been criticized by many, by other people we were supported, that peace-building projects mostly become effective when political agreement has been reached or has conflict has been resolved. But we end up continuing our projects in continuation of the conflict. So it's becoming like walking on a minefield. We don't know when the next mines will explode in our face. And we lose energy because also the education process is a long-term thing. You don't see the fruits or the results in a short time. It needs time to ferment and blossom and to bear fruits. How to sustain people hope and aspiration in the darkness of that time. But we were successful so far to produce these manuals, these materials, and we hope that many Palestinian schools, many Israeli schools, try to adapt it. And they are adapting it in contrary of the wishes of both side ministries. The other project is what the portrayal of each other in Palestinian and Israeli school books. There are indications that both sides' textbooks, there is so much improvement, you know, slowly developed inside of the textbooks in the level of dehumanization and demonization. The level of demonization, both sides' textbooks has really dropped down very drastically. Still, the issue of legitimations at the political level is very high. Still, you can find in the textbooks a kind of recognition of the other side, but not in its full pictures. And Ervin is right when he mentioned about the kind of shift in the Israeli textbooks. But that we have to take this also into consideration in the political development of each side. Here, Israel is a state, developed more than 6 years. Now, Palestinians still are struggling under the occupation, and where the future is becoming much more darkness and grim. In a much more stable society, it's a critical aspect of their own narrative. In those people like the Palestinians who are under oppression, that's still the critical look at your own historical narrative is very, very minimal. The other thing which is completely a surprising finding for us is that it's very difficult to move the narrative from personal to collective. It's easier, of course, to adapt to a new narrative as a person, but when you move that to collective, it becomes extremely difficult. But still, we feel that a micro approach to deal and to change the content of textbooks from denial, from delegitimization, to recognition and acceptance, it's a way forward.
Sarai Aharoni, let's bring you back in now. Given the hopelessness you have found expressed among women, how are attempts to maybe define or redefine women's roles within the peace processes or peace building, how would that be beneficial for both Palestinians and Israelis?
I'd like to start by thanking Sami for his insights, because I share some of these dilemmas. For example, the question of asymmetry and how to deal with the structured asymmetry between Israelis and Palestinians in general in a way that would be meaningful, in a way that will not just make each side entrenched in their own position, but understand the asymmetry in terms of the exposure to political violence. I know that Palestinian women have been more exposed to routine forms of insecurity. But I would like to say something about the bottom-up approach, and this is specifically relevant when we talk about women's roles, because women in Israel, as in many other places in the world, are not part of official decision-making. They're not a part of structures of negotiation, governmental structures of negotiations in Israel. These structures have been traditionally taken from military elites, political elites, professional academics, and these groups have been dominated by men. So women pick up the education or the resistance path or the dialogue path, so that we need to talk more seriously about the question of this whole problem from the top down. This really takes a lot of courage, which is what I think I'm currently lacking. I mean, being willing to pay the price that any kind of negotiated agreement will actually have to imply for both sides. And there are very clear issues on stake. We know that the problem of Jerusalem, the problem of borders, the issue of the right of return of Palestinian refugees, the settlements, these are core issues that both sides are not really willing to compromise on. And there's no way to bypass these questions. The other side of it is, are both societies willing to continue to pay the price of the burden of living under this protracted, continuing conflict? The prices are multifaceted. These are economic prices, these are psychological prices, these are ethical prices, these are prices that come in various forms in terms of the ability of groups of people to flourish and to fulfill their potential, right? And this is the way I think both people would like to see their future, although they cannot imagine this happening. And so how do we move from this situation to a different future? When I look at the younger generation, and again, education is a key issue, it's clear that young people in Israel and in Palestine don't really know the other. And this is very different than the situation that existed 20 or 30 years ago. So there is a very clear degree of separation between Israeli Jews and Palestinians. Today, the majority of Israelis understand the prices. So the question is, when and how, and will they be willing to pay the prices?
Given that you study the gender roles, do you think that there's an aspect of this that could be changed with a change in gender roles, with knowledge that there does seem to be a movement towards inclusion of women? Is this a possibility of incorporating these more what you called feminine aspects, not using force, using diplomacy of dealing with the other in the future?
I think this is a very promising hypothesis. Women's participation in governmental official politics in Israel could be a good indication to the internal domestic struggles within Israeli society, which is not a homogeneous society. Currently, we do see some emerging women leaders, especially Shelly Yachimovich, Tzipi Livni, Zehava Galon, and others, who have talked publicly about issues that deal with civilians, for example. These are very different women. Some of them are much more identified with the mainstream, masculine, or military point of view. Yet, there is a sense that Israeli women are starting to think about this question. What would it mean for us as women to have a woman leader that would speak a little bit differently about the conflict? And I won't raise any hopes here, because I don't think that women would actually believe in a major change, but rather would be able to buy a nuance here. Maybe we need to start from this a nuance just to start negotiating. And yes, I do think that currently women would be more in favor of starting negotiations.
I would like to reemphasize the role of education in creating coexistence between both sides. And I would like to emphasize that violence is not a war, it's not a way to resolve the conflict. Both society are intertwined by destiny that they should share this place somehow. Two-state solution is a viable approach, hopefully that could be reached. One-state solution with equal rights for each individual is an option that hopefully we will not have to think about. Both sides has to make a serious compromise, living side by side peacefully. Let's think about the war as part of the past, not as a part of our present situation. We would like the Israelis to teach about the Palestinian catastrophe in their schools, and we would like also to see the Palestinian teaching about the Holocaust in their education system. So to move even the conflict from being intellectual, political, rational, to be at the human and the social psychology level.
Sarai Aharoni.
I would like to thank Sami very much for his work. This is very, very hard to keep on working to develop shared understandings, even if they reflect different narratives in the current situation. At the same time, I know that over time we can see the fruits of some of these efforts. People like Sami and others give educators the tools to deal with these issues. When I meet women, I know that the question of tools and how do we learn how to talk about what has happened and what is happening is very important. So I agree that telling histories and telling stories and talking about what is happening now and what has happened is very powerful. And I hope that people who will learn how to tell these stories will also be able to change reality. Thank you.
Thank you. Irvin Staub is a professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's the author of award-winning books, including The Roots of Evil, The Origins of Genocide and Other Group Violence, The Psychology of Good and Evil, and Overcoming Evil. Sami Adwan is professor of education at Bethlehem University and co-founder and co-director of the Peace Research Institute in the Middle East. He is the co-author of numerous books, including Side by Side, Parallel Histories of Israel-Palestine, and Participation and Reconciliation, Preconditions of Justice. Sarai Aharoni is professor of political science and international relations at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. She is co-author of Where Are All the Women? UN Security Council Resolution 1325, Gender Perspectives of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Melissa Chiprin and Ankina Aghasyan. And most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go to kpfk.org and click on the archives. You can always podcast us. Follow us at thescholarcircle.org and at Armudian on Twitter. See you next week.